Welcome to It Shipped That Way, where we talk to product leaders about the lessons they've learned helping build great products and teams. I'm Alan Pike. Our guest today is product designer JC Ann Day. JC is an app designer, startup founder, creator of a world-famous onboarding workflow, and is currently a lead designer at GitHub. Welcome, JC.
Thanks, Alan. Always excited for our chats and excited to be on the podcast.
Yeah, it's been too long since we talked, and I figured why not, record it.
Yeah, exactly.
Today, we're going to talk about product onboarding, the aforementioned famous flow, and some of the interesting trade-offs that we face when we're building first-time user experiences. But first, I'd like to start with some context, give folks a chance to understand who you are and how you got here. What's like the short version recap of JC's story so far?
Yeah, so I first got into tech by, I was a receptionist at a real estate company, and I had a bunch of time sitting there. I didn't have much to do besides sit there, look pretty and greet guests. So I found out about coding and startups and taught myself how to code that way while I sat at this front desk. And through coding, made websites for this company that I was working for and realized quickly that I was much more of a designer, not a great coder. So that's how I first got into design. From there, then worked for a startup doing product design, UI UX design. And then while working there, I found out about Stable Clock Software. And it was one of these companies that I really wanted to work for, I remember. And I was like, yes, I'm going to work there someday. And then you reached out to me, as you know, had this interview, and then I got the job at Stable Clock.
And that was, I don't know what, like 8 years ago now? Feels like a long time ago.
7 years ago?
A few, couple lifetimes back.
Yeah, totally. So yeah, Stable Clock was great. Outside of work, I needed a big change in my life, so decided to move to Berlin. So at that point, then I started to do a bunch of freelance work for quite a few years, and then founded my own company, which was Avocado Bots, and that was chatbots for conferences and events. And with that, it was going pretty well, but then we couldn't find product market fit, and my co-founder left me. So it was a bit sad, but we decided to not continue with Avocado Bots, but I continued with some clients. One of them was Blinkist. And I was working on conversion, onboarding flows, subscriptions, and stuff like that there. And I absolutely love the team. They offered me a job. So I started there at Blinkist, which is, I think, the main thing we'll talk about today. Get into that later. And now I'm for GitHub for the past year. And I'm working on communities and discussions specifically on GitHub.
There's lots of kind of little pieces we can dig into, but I think, like you say, the Blinkist one is a good place to start. And so to give people just a little bit of context before we start talking about the work that you did there, do you want to recap a little for people what Blinkist is? Like, it's quite a successful business, but it's in a certain niche. So you want to kind of describe it a little?
Yeah, for sure. So Blinkist is like bite-sized books, basically. So it's like book summaries within 15 minutes. It's on web, but also an app. I worked on the app side of things. It has over 20 million users. Pretty cool app.
And so this is like a subscription service. You subscribe and you can get a certain number of summaries or usage per. Do they have a free plan at all? Or is it just trial and then you have to pay to keep using it?
Yeah, so there's a free version where you just get a blink per day. So Blinkist decides are just this random books basically per day that you can have that are free. But if the premium version is to have access to everything that's on the app.
So which is a pretty common like consumer prosumer oriented SaaS model is like you let people play around with it, but that it's paid. And so the business is driven by getting the subscriptions, which people don't like paying for things. So that's like kind of one of the core challenges of a business like that. And I know you did a project there, or at least one, maybe multiple, working on conversion on onboarding. But one in particular that you did there, it was so fun to see like the whole internet lighting up and like people that I follow blogs and things like that talking about this project that you did redesigning and having a pretty major impact on the conversion of their onboarding flow for getting people to subscribe and in a non-evil way, which is like part of what made it fun. So often it's like, oh, we found a way to make people subscribe by like just hiding the unsubscribe link or something like that. And you did the opposite. So tell us about how did that project come about?
Yeah. And just to add to that too, I definitely focus now when I say focus on conversion stuff, it's definitely always ethical conversion. And this is what made me get like really excited about that was, during the time at Blinkist. But yeah, this project came up. Basically since I started at Blinkist, I saw that in the app reviews, this was the top thing that people were complaining about was that when they sign up for the trial, it's a 7-day trial, and then they're charged that last day, which is a pretty standard thing across apps. But a lot of people would forget to cancel, forgot they signed up for the app, And then they would be charged on that seventh day and then be like, where did this come from? And write these reviews that were very angry and feel like they're being tricked into this. And when I brought it up at the beginning, it was kind of just this, like, people saying, like, well, this is just a normal thing in the industry. Like, every app does this.
What can you do? It's just the way it is.
Yeah, exactly. Like, everybody's doing this. This has, like, helped us for conversion for so much. Like, we can't go back on this. And I was like, let's just get rid of this subscription model entirely. Like, let's just make it free. But that was, like, way too in one direction, of course.
No revenue.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, as a designer being like, for the user, that's like kind of what my perspective was when I first joined there and saw this, but then realized that I kind of had to take a different approach. Like, how do we balance the business case for the company? How do we still make revenue, but also make it a good experience for the user? And then that was like a big aha moment for me in trying to pitch that in a different way.
So your goal was, let's try and decrease the number of complaints that we're getting from users or increase customer satisfaction, by improving this in some way. And so you set out to find a way to make it better that hopefully the business wouldn't reject because it would ruin the revenue.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's exactly how I pitched it basically. I was like, we should focus on this because if we reduce those customer complaints, growth will be better because we get more people using the app. Also, of course, it's ethically better. So just like internally, we're going to feel better about the product if we do some work on this. We don't know what it is yet. But yeah, the main goal was just to reduce those customer complaints. That was the first goal.
And so was there skepticism of like, well, it sounds like you already kind of said there was some skepticism, but I guess you and the folks on your team were able to get some backing to get at least a certain amount of design and development time to trying this out.
Yeah, exactly. So we didn't think it would increase conversion, but we just didn't want it to go down. So that was kind of the goal. And I just pitched it to some stakeholders that we should work on this and then brought it to a workshop with the team and some other stakeholders as well and said, like, here are some problems we can focus on. But basically unanimously, everybody said, this is the problem that we should be focusing on now. And then we came up with like potential solutions all together in that workshop with my team.
It's not a core topic, but I think that's kind of interesting. You mentioned like running a workshop. Like, how do you think about an sort of approach when you want to run workshops like this? Because I've seen huge variance in how different teams, even what they mean when they say, what is a workshop? So like, what does that mean to you in the general sense? And how did you find it helped at Blinkist?
Yeah, so I love running workshops to come up with ideas and get like everybody involved. I think that was a big part of it, just to get everybody kind of on board. So it's not just coming just from me. But yeah, with this workshop, it's like starting out with a bunch of research usually, or what we did for this one was a bunch of research. And then we come up with the problem statements basically from this research that we want to focus on potentially. And then we all voted for those, the problems that we thought were the top things we want to tackle. And then usually get everybody to do some sketches. So get everybody to do some ideas after voting on what things we want to focus on. And this, solutions. So we'll come up with some solutions and then sketch them.
Are you trying to get like the non-designer stakeholders that are in there to sketch too?
Yeah, I get everybody too, like engineers, product managers, whoever else is there. It's great.
One of the things that I've seen some teams struggle with over the last couple of years is that they were in person and now they're remote, and like how workshops change because the idea of like, oh, let's pull in everybody into this nice boardroom for 4 hours is like slightly more appealing, I think, to a lot of people than let's like try to be on a 4-hour Zoom call. So like, have you done anything like that in this sort of remote era that was as successful as what you were doing when you were able to do it in person?
Totally. I mean, those ones too were like half remote, some in person as well. So since the beginning, basically, it's been doing a lot of remote. I keep them to 2 hours now. I have them pretty fast and well done. I mean, I usually use the same kind of general format. And it's just like keeping our energy up and being really quick, like timing people and like making sure that it's like done within that 2 hours. If you don't go over, people are usually pretty happy.
Okay, yeah. All right, like that's good to hear because sometimes I feel a little bit, not bad, but like we on our teams have been pretty strict about short meetings. Like we try to make them half an hour for 50 minutes is common. And then occasionally it'll be like, all right, let's go wild and do a 2-hour like workshop or something like that. But I hear about other teams where they're like, well, we had a 6-hour workshop or a whole all day meeting or 2-day meeting. And like, just, like kind of want to die a little bit thinking about being on Zoom for that long. And so hearing other like successful teams sort of saying like, no, 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 like you can do it in 2 hours. We just need to be disciplined and then people will not resent you. I'm sure there's some things that you can't get done in 2 hours, but like, I don't know. I'm team 2 hour max for sure.
Yeah, totally. I mean, like not to slam design sprints, but I am a bit. I think design sprints for like a whole week is just way too long. So I just took like the best kind of pieces of that and then squish it into 2 hours. And then also what comes out of it is like wireframes done for me because everybody does sketches. So it's kind of skipping that step.
Nice.
As well, which is nice. Yeah, kind of keep up to do my job.
So you do your 2 hour workshop. You get everyone, including the product people and engineering people and whoever's involved to do some sketches. And then where did it go from there?
Yeah, so the number one thing everybody wanted to do was have some sort of like a screen that lets people know that they can cancel and like when to cancel within the trial and explain to them more like what the trial is, just to have more transparency. We also talked about having trial reminders so that after they subscribe, they can sign up for trial reminders. And then a day or two before their trial ends, we just send them a notification that says, hey, your trial is ending. Do you want to cancel? Do you want to stay? Or maybe you can check out the app and find something more. So that was generally the idea that everybody was excited about.
And I imagine that was something that was a little concerning to certain stakeholders. You're like, what, you're going to remind people to cancel their trial? Like, that sounds like a bad idea.
Yeah, totally. I mean, that was obviously a concern. And everybody thought that conversion or like cancellation of trials would go way up. And we said, okay, it could go down by 10%, but this is good ethically. So we do want to have it, but like, that's the limit.
You could also imagine a decreasing churn where if like fewer people convert to paid, but then maybe more of the people who convert to paid will still be around after 6 months. You could imagine.
Yeah. I mean, at that point, we didn't really think that way. We just were like, okay, like we just want to reduce these complaints because we want to get like more people to be using the app.
So you went in and you did a design pass, I imagine. Spent 6 months perfecting it so that it would be perfectly beautiful.
No, definitely not. So we decided for the first test, what we would do is the trial reminder. So before we do this like new subscription screen, like let's see how many people actually cancel. With this, I did designs like using basically stuff we already had. So it was pretty quick. I also coded it myself because we were using this tool that you could easily update the screen and put it in there. We were able to do this quite quickly. And then, yeah, we did have problems, but we were able to test this. So we wanted to run this as an A/B test, of course. And we had this A/B tester set up. We A/B tested everything all the time. So yeah, we put this out into the world to see what would happen. And we actually saw that 4% fewer people canceled, which was surprising when we thought there'd be 10% more people canceling. So that was a huge surprise. And then we also saw push notification go from 6% to 74%, which was a huge bump.
So more than 10 times increase in like a core
like 1,116% increase or something like that. Like, so because of these results, of course, we decided, okay, let's roll this out. So we fixed it up a bit and rolled it out to everybody.
That's amazing.
So yeah, and then from that, like we were like, okay, where do we go from here? Like, this is amazing results. Like, let's keep riding this wave. What do we do with this? And then we went back to this idea of like changing the subscription screen to letting people know that they have this option of the reminder and letting them know that, yeah, we'll remind them 2 days before so they can cancel. So we wanted to, yeah, continue with this. And so I did some mockups for that, like did some different ideas, maybe like a swipe thing, some other design. I don't know. There was different like wireframes, but we ended up wanting to do like a timeline. So like having like 3 steps and showing what happens at each step. So like today you get access. In 5 days, you'll be reminded by notification or email that your subscription is ending and you'll have to pay. Sorry, that your trial is ending, that you'll have to pay for the subscription. And then in 7 days, then if you don't cancel, you have access to everything. So as you still do now. So that was like the design that we wanted to test out.
Like a visual representation of what the next week is going to look like.
Yeah. So then we designed this. I did some user testing on this, of course. And people really loved it. So like we showed them the app and we showed them the subscription screen and like asked them their favorite part. And they were like, this subscription screen, it's just so transparent. I love this, like even more than the app, which was very, very weird.
So you did a whole app usability test, and they were like excited about the thing that's trying to get them to get a subscription.
It wasn't like the whole app, but we still showed them like the discovery screen and like what the app's about afterwards. So that was like clear, like, okay, let's definitely do an A/B test for this. And there were some small fixes that I made to the design, and decided to roll this out again as an A/B test to see how this works. Yeah. Our goal at this point was 10% increase in, trial opt-ins,
which would be huge.
Yeah. That's also big. That was usually like our goal for each of our tests. So that was our goal.
And what did you see?
After rolling this out, we checked back and it was a 23% increase in trial opt-ins, which was way more than that 10%. So that was amazing.
That's amazing. 23% trial opt-in increase. Like, so that's more people are opting into the trial. Did it decrease how many people are sticking with it afterwards?
Yeah, so that would still be like the 4% before, because we still had the screen that you could opt into push notifications for the trial reminders.
Right.
So the retention we still saw was still 4% more. And then the trial signups were 23% more.
So in the aggregate how many person weeks have we gone into this project at this point?
Very little, to be honest. I mean, I was like thinking about this for like 9 months until we started to actually do it, but I was not actively working on it. But then the actual time, like we'd usually run these tests for 2 weeks. Development time was usually 2 weeks, and then I would work on it for maybe a couple weeks. So maybe everything together was a month, or maybe a little over a month, just waiting for the results for the test before as well.
And then as a result, you have a product that has millions of users, has like multiplicative, like 25% times plus another 25% plus a 60-some percent or 1,000% increase of this metric. Like the aggregate impact of revenue had to have been at least 50% increase to the business. Like this is wild.
Yeah, it's crazy huge. So this is, yeah, obviously like a huge one. We still like the original goal, when we go back to that, was like this like decreasing of the customer complaints.
Oh yeah, the customer complains. I've gotten all excited about revenue. And you're like, but what about the users? Yeah. Do they like it?
But we had to wait a few months, of course, because we had to see like if they're still complaining or they stopped complaining and stuff like that. So we waited a while for that, then got the results back of that. And we saw that there was decreased complaints by 55%, which was also amazing. Yeah.
Wow. And your goal was 10% or something? Like, oh man. So 55% decrease in your biggest customer complaint, all the metrics going for the roof. Stacey's now the CEO.
Totally, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Should have been. So it was amazing. A lot of those complaints that were still coming in about this, like even though it decreased by 55%, a lot of the complaints were still from like 3 years ago. Somebody was scoring and they got charged, and they're still.
Oh, and they've now noticed.
Like, yeah, they just keep on like complaining everywhere about it forever. So yeah.
So it's probably just continued to decrease since then. That is so awesome. So that feels like the kind of thing you'd want people to know about when you've had such an amazing discovery.
Once again, like I think subscription and conversion stuff can be just like a lot more ethical, like we talked about before. And I really wanted other apps to do this. Like if every app is doing this and there's like 55% less people being screwed over by this, then that's great for the world. So yeah, I wrote this Medium article about it and posted it, and then it just got like a lot of response from this. So
yeah, that was the point where I was exploding all over my various social timelines, and I even saw it on LinkedIn. Like, you know, I try not to spend too much time on LinkedIn, but it's like, oh, wow. It's like, JC's everywhere. This is awesome.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it was really cool. I mean, that's exactly what I wanted, because I want people to be implementing this. I think now, like every second app I download and look at, they have this timeline screen and I'm like, there's my designs.
Nice. So it was cool. The ones that you hack together in a week yeah. with this
actually,
weird tool.
It's actually terrible too, because like the actual timeline design, I really didn't like. Like I still am not super excited about the UI. So I had to like fit it into this like certain box and stuff. So it was like really a lot of constraints, but everybody's copied it. So I guess it's not so bad.
Well, maybe that's an opportunity for you. At some point you end up working on another onboarding subscription flow and you're like, no, now my goal is to do even better than that. I've got to one up myself.
Yeah, totally. It's my time.
So what was like the most kind of surprising? You got all this attention and you had people blogging about it and linking it and talking about it and celebrating this this discovery, basically, like this thing that could have people could have found years ago, or maybe no one might have found for more years, but you've kind of discovered and popularized this thing that's sort of, it's better for users and better for businesses, which is like one of those rare, just like, okay, like everybody should basically just do this if you have a business like this. What was the most like surprising thing that came from all that attention and movement?
Yeah, I mean, from that, it was really cool to see people like kind of remixing it and doing their own version, like adding steps, like 1, 2, 3, like a checkbox. I think that could also be better if that was there and people tested that, which is cool. I also had this like Oma, she emailed me and said, I'm a 80-year-old Oma or something like that. And thank you so much for doing the screen, because I always get charged unexpectedly and this is so great. And I was like, oh, this is so sweet. So that was awesome.
That's great.
And that just makes me feel good getting these emails, like people try it out and just hearing from them. But then of course, like the biggest thing was Apple. Somebody tagged me in this on Twitter that Apple is now like recommending this to apps and had a video with the screen that they now recommend to everyone. And this was one of my goals and still is to somehow get into like Apple guidelines. So like Apple suggest this to everybody. But yeah, it was really cool to see there, but kind of startling too, because it was exactly my designs, but they just changed the name of the app. But I still think this is better for the world. But yeah, that was the biggest surprise.
That's very cool. I think that there's a lot of people who wish they could impact what Apple's policies and preferences are and what they advocate for developers. And it's fun to come across a thing. It was like, you can actually come up with something that is a big enough impact that they're like, okay, this is the way the app should be now.
Yeah, totally.
As much as our frustration is sometimes like it can be difficult to steer them.
So yeah, that was really good. I mean, it's good for Apple. They're going to be making a lot more money off of it. And
yeah, I haven't thought about that. They make 30% of all these or 50%
exactly.
of all these.
Exactly. And if apps, like I've seen people go up like 20 to 50% increase in conversion. So for Apple, figuring out that how much money they're making from it is quite a bit.
Yeah, I was thinking about how much money you made for Blinkist, but you probably made Apple billions. Like so many, like tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars, maybe billions. I don't even know the scale. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations. You're waiting on your check.
Yeah,
now.
Exactly. So yeah, thanks. So yeah, when I first saw it, I was really excited. And then I was like, wow, I could have made a lot more money from this. but anyway, it's still good for the world. I still wish they had kind of reached out before they did post it, 'cause they never did. But otherwise, yeah, it's cool.
There's something about our industry that I find sort of fascinating, that there are things like this that are kind of discoverable. Like I was saying, like someone else could have in theory tried this and tested this out at any given point. And if you hadn't, then it might have been longer. But then once we discover it, or like pull the refresh is one of those things, right? Like it was originally the Tweety Twitter app that was like, oh, maybe if you like pull down, then you can like load more tweets. And then people were like, oh, that's clever. Like, oh, that's kind of cool. But then eventually everybody was kind of like, yeah, I'm pretty much, I think we should just do this. I think this is just the way software works now. And so it's kind of interesting to be like one of those little like building bricks of getting us there.
Totally. And yeah, I think that's like peak of my career. So that's great.
Yeah, so far. So far. No. You're gonna make tens of billions of dollars within your next thing. On Blinkist, one last thing I thought was interesting is this. So you wrote this Medium post, and I think some companies have a bit of a tendency to, when there is some discovery of a design change they've made, especially something as profound as this, to maybe be a little skeptical of like, oh, I don't know, should we share this? Like, is this competitively advantageous to us to not share it? So was that like a difficult sell for you to pitch, or was it kind of like a no-brainer of like, yeah, this is going to get, I mean, we're all talking about Blinkist now, and I've been, I guess celebrating this product. So it ended up being a win for them, I think. But was that a difficult decision?
No, not really. I was really lucky with Blinkist that they had this policy, like you can share whatever, like as long as it's live, you can share anything about like the process or what you designed. Like it's totally fine to do any of these use cases. So, I mean, I asked about it. I also asked if it should be posted like under Blinkist's Medium or something, but they said like, no, it's going to get bigger reach if you do it under, I think I put it on under some other publication, UX Planet or something. So they said, yeah, just like do what you want, basically. So I was lucky.
Yeah, that's something that we're getting to the point now with Steamclock where I used to be the only one that would write about what we were doing. But one of the things over the last couple of years we've been doing, getting more and more successful with, is like having other folks on the team write about it. And we don't have a lot of like policy other than like, can you say if we've shipped something, then like, yeah, let's write about it. It's always heartening to me to see these examples of like a big win when it's like we did something good. Do great work and then tell people about it is the loop that I like. So I think it's a great example of that.
Yeah, I wish more people did that too, so we could all learn from each other. But more of these like kind of cases, like this big wins and stuff. I agree.
Yeah, it's scary that a lot of people are able to convince themselves that they can't write. And that like writing is some sort of dark art or something that you were like born able to do or not when, I don't know, my thinking on it as someone who went from sort of objectively not being able to write and now like writing okay, is like practice and time and investment and re-editing.
Yeah, like, totally. And it's a lot more about like in this case, in my case, at least, it's like a lot about the content as well. I'm just like showing this design and stuff. So yeah.
Yes.
But yeah, your writing is great. You're a really good writer.
Oh, thank you. So onboarding kind of more broadly out, do you have any projects that come to mind that you've worked on that you'd be interested to kind of like anything that you remember, lessons learned or difficulties or challenges or even just frustrations on other onboarding projects you've worked on either at Blinkist or other products? I know you and I both, in between the two of us, have worked on dozens of onboarding flows and products.
Yeah, for sure. I think the most I worked on is Blinkist. So I think it's like most interesting about the Blinkist stuff. With that, like we just made like this whole like onboarding flow. Like we discovered through data that most subscriptions come from like that first subscription screen. I think this is pretty standard across apps. So everything that was kind of working towards subscription should be before that. I mean, you could invest after, but a lot of it is better that it's in the onboarding before. And we kind of had to find this balance too between like, okay, for conversion, but then also like for engagement, like for people to actually be onboarded into the app. And I kind of had the vision before. At the beginning, there wasn't really a long onboarding at Blinkist, and we just decided to make it just like really short. And that increased conversion, like getting rid of the sign up in the flow, for example, I think increased conversion by 10%. And I was under the impression that like longer onboarding will decrease conversion, but we realized that it actually didn't change much if we add a bunch of screens before, which I thought was really interesting.
Oh, interesting. So was this one of the flows where they force you to go to the end, or like you have to quit the app in order to get out of it? Or could you like cancel, could you X out of the onboarding flow?
We had that you could skip on like the first part of the onboarding flow, but then after that you had to stay in.
Okay. So if you went one or two screens in, then it's like, we got
then you. Then you're in there, yeah.
And that's interesting because a lot of the onboarding flows that I've worked on, there's either no skip at all or there's skip at each point. And so we've often seen, I'm not an onboarding expert, which is why I'm talking to you. But we have often seen metrics where you make them longer and so then more people skip. You lose certain people at each step. So what you're saying, at least for Blinkist, was that if you don't have a skip on the first screen, like obviously that's bad because there's some percentage of people who are not willing to go through it. So they'll just be on the app entirely. But if they're willing to go to the second screen, then you can sort of get away with sort of now, okay, now I've got you. And then you have to kind of, not in an unethical way, now I have a half an hour of onboarding screens. But like now if you have six or seven, like they're going to go through them probably. And there's not too much difference in between five and seven at that point. Or I assume that's kind of the range of numbers you're talking about. You're not talking about 20 screens.
Yeah, exactly. And we looked at the data as well. And like, so on that first screen, there'd be a drop, but then all the other screens after that, it was like very minimal or no drop at all. Like people would stay through the whole process, even if it was seven screens. So it'd be like, whoop, and then they'd just stay.
Okay.
So with this, it just gave us a lot of room to experiment with more ideas and put it into the onboarding and see what effects conversion, for example, what people like in the onboarding, this sort of thing. So I really focused on that then.
What did people like? What were the things that you saw that were the biggest positive impacts, other than the reminding people about their subscription, which was like world class, 10 out of 10.
Yeah. So with that one, yeah, of course, that was really good. We said to people, like one thing that came up was like, we would ask like, how much time per day would you like to learn? And we would give them some options, like 5, 10, whatever minutes. And then we had a screen after that would say, like, you'll save 56 hours of reading this week.
That would be a lot.
Yeah. And yeah, okay, it's a bit ridiculous. But anyway, but this is like one of the, we found this is like the main use case, like people really wanted to like save time and stuff. So that's why we kind of rolled with that, because that's like the user feedback from interviews and stuff that we got. So we actually did 56 hours as the A/B test, not like just put 56 hours all the time, not matching what they entered there, like 15, 35, whatever.
During the A-B test,
yeah,
just to see.
And then we were like, okay, this is not super ethical because it's like this random number, but whatever, let's just see how it goes. I think it increased conversion by 9% or something like that. There was an increase. And so we're like, okay, well, let's build this actually real, that it actually matches what kind of like time that they chose. And when we did that, conversion went down. So,
oh no, because they were like 56 hours. I can't afford 56 hours. I need to subscribe.
But then there were some that were higher. Like, I don't know. I don't know. People just like the number 56. Like there wasn't really
56.
Like, it was like, that's the
conversion
number.
Conversion pro tip.
Exactly. Use the number 56. Yeah. That's my point of the story. No, but with that, but we still ended up, I think it like balanced out in the end that it wasn't decreasing or increasing, or maybe it was like 2% increase or something. So we decided to roll it out with the actual numbers just because we're all about ethics now. Like we don't want to be lying to these people what these numbers actually are. So we decided to roll it out, even though the 56 would have been better, but it still was good for the user.
Yeah, I like that mentality. And obviously it's complicated when you get into a business, especially as a business starts to scale, where there are little levers that you can pull where you can make money. And the bigger you get, the more money on the lever. If you make $1 billion by sort of telling what they would maybe call a white lie, but then the people who are then spending money on the idea that they're saving 56 hours, but it's actually 11 hours or 1 hour, yeah, or maybe it's not so white to them when their real money is at hand.
Yeah.
One of the examples I came up recently as a reading that Lyft and Uber misestimate how soon your driver will be here. It says that they'll be here in 1 minute for the last 2 minutes.
Oh.
And they both do this. And it's one of these like, oh, this is unethical. It's like, yeah, but like we calculated we'll lose like $1 billion of people like not being there for when the ride is there, or rides just not completing, or people not being willing to. And so it just like basically decreases all the numbers by 1 minute.
Oh my goodness.
And it's one of those like, oh, if the Congress made us both fix it, then we could do it. But if our competitor does it and we don't, then...
Yeah.
Or at least they tell themselves. Maybe there's an ethical solution to it. But it's way harder to measure the mistrust that generates when it's like, I've been standing here for 2.5 minutes, because sometimes it's wrong, right? I know that it's been way more than a minute, and I still don't know where my driver is or whatever. So.
Yeah, totally. I didn't even know this was a thing, but I mean, it kind of makes sense because I feel like it's always longer when I'm waiting, especially here. But yeah, I think as well, like to add to that though, too, I think like before you even launch these tests, I think it's really important to think of the ethics and what could come out of this, like that you rethink like different directions that you could do that still help the business case, but are ethical. There's definitely things that I've seen too, because it's like, okay, let's just do it as a test. But like, no, like we don't ever want to do this. Thinking about the ethics, like as early as possible in every project that you do, I think is so important.
Were there any other things from the sort of testing and onboarding process, that work that you've done that come to mind, either as like interesting wins or things that were a net win, or things that were like, wow, this totally didn't work. Like, what a waste. Or let's not do that one.
Yeah, totally. Like another good one too was saying cancel a lot on the subscription screen. So the more times we said cancel on the subscription screen, so like on the button and an FAQ, like in the timeline, we just write like, you can cancel everywhere. We saw conversion go up every time. And then at some point we're like, okay, we are saying it way too many times. We have to like put a limit on this, because all you see is cancel.
It's getting ridiculous.
It's just like, cancel.
You can cancel cancellation for your optimal canceling experience.
So. You should. I kind of want to experiment with that one. That's a good one.
Yeah.
That is intense. But yeah, so that was an interesting one. So just making sure it's really, really clear on your subscription screen. I recommend people to do that.
Did that come out of talking to people about what feelings they had when going through the screen? Or was it just a guess of like, oh, we think maybe people are... maybe like they being reminded that they can cancel.
We also saw like feedback, like in reviews or talking to users and things like that, that they're like, I don't understand how to cancel. Like how do I cancel in the app or an app store or what? So that's why we added this FAQ to say like, this is how you can cancel. And I wanted to also put this in settings as well, but for now we just had it on the subscription screen to tell them how they can. So that was definitely from users as well.
So this is like in the onboarding, user installs the app, they're going through, they go past the first screen where they can get out, and then they're in their seven steps. And one of those seven steps has an FAQ before they've even started using the app.
No, that's actually a good idea to try that out as well. But this was on the subscription screen. We made it like a longer scrollable screen that under the timeline, we have like a section that says how to cancel. And then you go to here and press this. And so it's actually on the subscription screen. There was definitely a lot of failures for sure. I mean, there was one screen that like I really wanted to like bring some delight into this because it was all pretty like static, kind of answering questions, going through. So I was like, oh, I want to do this like scale thing of like how many books you read to like time and like, I don't know, this like axis, and you could like drag it and it would have this effect. And then I was like really excited about this, and we spent all this time like developing this thing, and it still didn't even work perfectly well at the end. And I was so sure of it and I was so attached to it, but then we put it out to users and like I didn't user test it first before either, which was a mistake. I always user test, but we saw conversion go like way down because of this. And like,
oh no.
So I did like a post-mortem user test on it to figure out why, and like people just like didn't get it. Like it just didn't make any sense, and it was like hard to use and it was too complicated, so they would just like ditch the app.
We had a few of those with our we built as like a fun side project this spy game, as you know. That it took us a few iterations to get to the point where, because we built this little strategy game, and it's like, oh, this is cool, it's nice and simple, but the rules behind it were a little bit more complicated than it seemed at first, because you couldn't see what your opponent was doing because it's a spy game, right? So that seemed like a cool idea for a game, but next time if I ever make a game, I'll make a game again one day, but my next game will not have this component where you can't tell what your opponent is doing and your opponent can't tell what you're doing, because it makes it way harder to teach the game, right? You look at a game like Monopoly and you can just see this is the board and this is what's on it. Where it's like, oh, but you can't see, or maybe you can. It's mysterious, which like mystery does not help with like user understanding in those like first 5 minutes. And so we had so many user tests and so many experiments and so many onboardings and tutorial things and changes of the rules and simplifications. And of course, all the people who did understand the game were like, oh, you're ruining the game by simplifying it in this way. And the new people are like, I have no idea what's happening. I'm just dying repeatedly to the other players.
Oh man, I remember the spy game as well when I was there at Steampunk. I mean, I was kind of working on it, but I was like, I don't even really get it. So like, but
yeah, you were one of the first like user testers where it's like, okay, you're helping us design this thing. It's like, oh, can you test this out? And you just like make a move. And I'm like, oh no, the fact that you thought that is a move that would be reasonable means that I've failed in my game design.
So good. But I saw now though, recently, like I was looking at it, like it's been doing pretty well, hey? I was like, yeah, spy game.
It's had almost 1 million players now.
Oh my God.
Which is, I never expected. Yeah.
So exciting.
Yeah, so it's not quite like $1 billion. We did not make $1 billion for Apple, but we had 1 million people play, which is cool. And we learned a lot. We definitely, that game, now we're getting way off topic. It's fine. That game taught me something that I knew intellectually, but I now have kind of more in my soul, which is that business model is the product. Like, it's not the only part of the product, but a product without a business model, and going in with the idea, sort of like you with the, oh, wouldn't it be great if Blinkist just didn't have subscriptions and it was just free for everyone? Like, it would be more ethical. And it's like, well, not, it wouldn't really help users, because then there would be no Blinkist and then they would have no
exactly,
benefits,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
It wouldn't exist anymore. And that was what we did with this game, which was, we work on mobile primarily, but we don't do games because we had this idea of, oh, well, mobile game market is all just about tricking people into buying 10,000 gems. And that's not something that appealed to us. And we really wanted, if we were going to work on a game, we wanted to do a mobile because that's where we enjoy working. And we wanted to do a game that was not like that, and that it had ethical and really user-centric purchasing model. And so we designed the whole game with that sort of not in our heads about like, okay, well, what is that purchasing model? And then it's like, okay, it's time to launch the game. It's like, well, how's it going to make money? It's like, well, I guess we'll sell like cosmetic items into a two-dimensional spy strategy, right? Which I'm pretty confident was the least bad monetization strategy for the game that we developed. Like, we tested a bunch and we did a bunch of evaluation, did a bunch of user, like, look at different ways. Like, we could just charge up front for the game and a bunch of things. But I think we maximized our revenue given the game that we designed and built. But we designed and built a game that can't be profitable, right? Like, so we sort of, like, put ourselves in a hole. And it's like, oh, I'm stuck in this hole, like, you know, but that was like a product design failure. And I knew that intellectually before. Like, if someone had come to me for advice and they had said they were going to do what I was going to do, then I would have had told them all that. But I didn't feel it to my own soul of like, no, well, therefore, like, good game design and good product design is finding compelling products that also are profitable and can pay for themselves. So that's obvious, but like now I know it in my bones.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I kind of learned that it's like similar to this project as well. I mean, I also learned that too. I mean, I think this is something that, like, I don't know, we say is obvious now, but I don't think it is obvious. I mean, a lot of designers are just like, okay, just for the user, like we have to do this for the user, but you have to think of like this business impact as well, and like how you make monetization strategies and all of these things too. Like you have to do it for both. So
yeah, I think sometimes that mentality comes out of an adversarial culture that can leech into certain companies. And like, obviously you want to do your best to try not let this happen in your company. But sometimes you get companies where there's the business, which like I dislike that as a phrase, like, oh, well, what does the business want? It's like, the business is like individual people. They're trying to make good decisions, right? You start referring to them as the business, you're already getting into adversarial, right? But like, oh, the business wants this thing that I think is unethical or not good for users, right? Like the 56 yeah. hours or whatever, right? And so then people will get into the mentality is like, well, I'm the designer, and so I'm going to try to protect the user, and the business is going to try to get evil business outcomes, and then we're just going to try to compete and as good versus evil, mm-hmm. right? And that mentality can seep in when there's a really large company and you don't have necessarily a great understanding of how the people on the quote-unquote business side are making decisions. And it creates the zero-sum mentality sometimes where you end up with. Then double down, the business is like, oh, all these designers are trying to make the subscription free or design a game with no business model. And so we have to like ignore them because, you know, and then everything just kind of corrupts down into, it's almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy when you start behaving that
yeah,
way.
Yeah, exactly. Totally. 100%.
So here's to a new generation, well, the current generation, but the continued growth of this product and business mm-hmm. working together in harmony and finding huge wins and making billions of dollars for well, for everybody, hopefully.
Yes, hopefully. Yes, that's what I want to see in the world.
It's been wonderful having you on the show, and thank you for making the time.
Thanks for having me.
How do people find more about you and your work?
Yeah, so you can find me online as 2Average on Twitter, Mastodon, or wherever. I'm JC Day on LinkedIn. I'm thinking about getting back into conversion, and so thinking about doing some consulting. So if anybody's interested in that, then they can email me at hi@jcday.com, or if you just want to chat about anything, you can email me.
Awesome. Well, we'll link all of those up in the show notes. It Shipped That Way is brought to you by Steam Clock Software. If you are a growing business and your customers need a really nice mobile app, get in touch with Steam Clock. You can give us feedback or rate the show by going to itshipped.fm or at itshippedfm on Twitter. We should get that Mastodon going as well. Although you can actually find Steam Clock on Mastodon now. We're at Steam Clock on hackyderm.io, which I will not spell out, but you can. It's Mastodon. It's just the wild, wild west right now, but it's fun. So check us out. Give us feedback. Tell us how you feel about the show, whichever way works for you. And until next time, keep shipping.